let's get right back to it. Courtney Brown, Daz Smith, and Jim Mars, and we are hearing some amazing things from Daz. What I'd like to do this hour is let Daz run along with as much as he can get in. The video of this is available at Farsight, and we'll tell you about that again as we continue. Jim, anything you want to add as we work our way from the shooters up to the string pullers?
No, although I just totally agree with Courtney. I mean, there are probably some details and minutia of this assassination that will probably never be known. I mean, as an old cop reporter on a homicide, you know, if they can figure out who did it and prove that, that's, yeah, you know, that's great. But there's always going to be some loose ends and some things that don't quite, you know, that we don't quite see. And it would take an extraordinary remote viewing effort to try to pick up all those details. So I'm with Courtney when the thing to understand is that there was a military-style ambush on President Kennedy, and it's been covered up at the level of the federal government.
Indeed, and even higher than that, I suspect. All right, yeah. Daz, floor is yours, sir.
Okay, well, we should just finish up on the shooter bit before we move on to the planners. Yeah, so I clearly describe on video, live on camera, two sets of shooters, and I try not to use the word shooters during the remote viewing or bullets or anything, so in place of bullets, I use explosive motion and energy that stop the vehicle and stop the person in the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I trace these back to points of origin, and they came from two different directions in front of the vehicle and the passenger. And what surprised me was the groups of people, they were very calm in what they were doing, and it was clearly a plan. And I wrote this down on the board at the time, I remember this. It was a clearly planned, executed event. Very organized. You know, the whole thing was very regimented, what they were doing. And the two sets of shooters, I felt, were in groups of three. There was one doing the activity, there was one watching the activity, and I felt there was a third person, but that third person was always a few feet or more behind the two doing the activity. He was almost, and I think I used the word like a rear guard action there, a bit of a security type arrangement.
Makes sense, Jim?
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing here is these two sets of three shooters, both from the front but from opposite sides. Is it possible if someone had fired a gun from the rear but did not strike Kennedy, is it possible that you would not have particularly picked up on that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, with remote viewing, we never get absolutely everything with our sessions. And because there was two of us doing the remote viewing, what happens, and we don't know how this process works, but the task is always in some way split up between the remote viewers without them knowing, so that there's not really huge amounts of duplication of work. So if, you know, for example, if I was picking up on, well, I also pick up a lot in my paper and pen sessions and on the board sessions of who I feel is Zapruder videoing the event. I clearly have that in all my sketches. I don't think Dick picks up on that part, so I pick up on a part and he doesn't, so on a part I may pick up on, I may not pick up on, that may be because Dick's picked up on it in some way.
I see, yeah, so you're each having seen different aspects, so
yes.
What I'm getting at is there seems to be some pretty good evidence that there was a shot or shots fired from the rear in the general direction of the book depository or perhaps the Daltex building, which is right kind of behind it and beside it. But if those shots missed, then there's you might not even have chance to look at that.
Well, Jim, that was one of the differences between Daz's and Dick's sessions. Both of them got the shots off to the right, which would have been in the car to the right, which would have been the Grassy Knoll area.
Right.
Daz also had shots coming from the driver's side left. But
it's entirely possible. There have always been some contention that there was a shot from the south Grassy Knoll.
Yeah.
In fact, Sherry Feister did some, she is a forensics expert, and she says that she believes a shot or shots came from the south Grassy Knoll, which would be to the left of the car.
Yeah, the driver's side left. Now, Dick, however, had people at the back, at a upper level, higher story, coming shooting from the back. So really, we have, if you look at all the descriptions, remote viewing descriptions of people shooting, Dick had a team, again, like a three-person team, behind the car at a higher altitude, like a few floors up. And he also had people who were in the old courthouse that he called the old Gothic building, and he drew with incredible accuracy. If anyone is ever wondering about could remote viewing be real, just look at Dick's description of that old Gothic building that is the actual old courthouse. I mean, that is such an unbelievable, unique architecture. It looks like a castle, and Dick describes it to the T. So Dick had some shooters from behind. Dez had two teams from either side. So that leaves open to the question of, you know, was there some decoding? Obviously, there was more than one shooter from different directions. Was it decoding errors, or was there, in fact, three teams of shooters?
Sounds like they both got parts of the whole.
That's how I'm sort of thinking of it. I'm thinking that Dez got the two teams off to the front on the either side, the grassy knoll and the lower area, and Dick got the grassy knoll and
the rear guard,
the ones mm-hmm. behind. And so that's what I'm seeing.
That really fascinating to me is that myself and many other serious researchers for years now had pretty well figured out that we suspected there was three teams of three persons each creating a triangulation of fire, which is standard sniping procedure. That's the way you do it. You get a triangulation of fire coming from three directions. So if there were indeed three shooter teams of three persons, that's nine people, okay? But anyway, so you got three shooters, and everybody said there were three shots. Well, I've always figured that it's actually, we're talking about three volleys. And there's plenty of evidence to indicate that they were radio controlled. They were in radio communication with each other. I think Dick even mentioned radio control.
Well, you got a picture, Jim, of one guy with a radio.
Guy with the radio, yeah. So there, you got three shooters from three directions, radio controlled. The first shot is just one loud boom, okay, and it reverberates around, and then at that point now they're in a rush. Now they got to hurry up and get off the next shot. And I think that what happened was is that you had three volleys, and as the signal was given that more shots were needed and they had to fire again, now there's more pressure and there's more intensity, and I think that the final volley was ragged. So you got a boom boom. And that's, I know, the thing that tipped me off from that very weekend was that you cannot get a boom-boom with a bolt-action rifle.
Yeah. So if I could add something to this, as someone who analyzes this high quality of remote viewing data, when you're analyzing low quality remote viewing data, there's a tendency to say, let me disregard that piece of information. This one's right. That's probably wrong. And sort of to dismiss certain things. When you have remote viewing data at this quality, to make those decisions is a real mistake. So if I were to say, you know, there was probably only two teams and maybe there was some decoding errors in terms of which direction, that would be my mistake. That would be a real crucial mistake. With these level of viewers, with Daz Smith and Dick Allgaier, the proper way to analyze these data is an accumulation process. So if you look at it that way, you'd say, okay, Daz got two teams in the front at sort of a triangular way and with a sort of a opposite sides of the road, and let's just leave it at that. Don't try to say there might have been a decoding error because I want to have one team behind so they couldn't have two teams in front. Just don't go there. Don't try to do that. Say, okay, Dez got two teams in front, one on either side of the road. Dick got one of those teams, the one to the right, the passenger side right of the car, and he also got one behind. Now, the accumulation process when you're dealing with this level of remote viewing is the only really way to approach, and that's to say, okay, then all of that's probably correct. So we have two teams in the front and one team in the back. At this point, that's where you turn to someone like Jim Mars and ask about exactly what he just talked about, the triangular process, the triangulation process. Both Daz and Dick both describe these particular marksmen as like paramilitary, like formerly within governmental operations, perhaps no longer working as freelance, but nonetheless with that level of training and that type of connections, and really expert marksmen. They know how to do their stuff. They've done it before. And those guys do actually triangulate, just as Jim Mars actually said. Okay. So if you look at it as an accumulation process for analyzing these data, don't dismiss any of it. Just say, okay, this is what Daz got, add what Dick got, you have a triangle.
Well, exactly, as soon as you step in and start subjectively doing that, you're really fouling things up. And you're right. I understand exactly what you're saying. Okay, let's get back to Daz and onward.
Okay, and as well as the two sets of shooters that I had from the front, as Courtney said, there was a clear and emotional disconnect from these guys. You know, they were very professional in what they were doing, very removed from it. It was a very cold feeling from these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, very professional. And as well as the two sets of shooters, I clearly record in all the data, a person off to one side observing. You know, he was an important person that I singled out, and he was observing the event, recording it, and I clearly felt that, you know, this was me getting the Zapruder connection in on the remote viewing data as well.
Actually, Daz did two things. The third member of each team was an observer that stood behind, and after the shooter and the helper walked off, the third guy would walk where they actually were standing or sitting or lying down when they were shooting and make sure there was nothing left. Picked up all the gunshots, I mean, all the shells, make sure there was nothing left. And then they walked off. And one of the teams, they all walk off in separate directions. And another team, they all walk off together. So they had a configuration that was coordinated so that it wouldn't look traceable. It was a different type of thing each time. And then Daz spent a lot of time discussing what is only could be described as Zapruder himself, the guy who was recording it all on film. And that's what Daz was just talking about now. So he had this other observer going on, this civilian guy who was just recording everything. Fascinating stuff. When you watch this stuff, you say, my Lord, how could this possibly? But at this level of remote viewing, magic actually does happen.
Well said.
Okay. Well, and the idea of the three-man teams, again, this is standard sniper tactics. You have a shooter, and then you have a second or a spotter.
Yeah.
And the spotter, and then you have a security guy who's usually back behind them a little bit to make sure nobody just walks up on them from behind when they're concentrating to the front. This is just SOP. It's standard operating procedure.
Very good. All right. Okay, Daz.
Okay, so I guess we should move on now to the people that are the focus of these the new second DVD that's out, and that really is focusing on the people that planned this event, and my whole data on this revolves around two groups of people. Both groups of people were male. The first group, I call them the primary group. Now they were very business orientated. You know, it was almost like I was watching or looking at CEOs of a company. It was all very, because I have to talk in how it feels, you see, when I'm doing reviewing, and it all felt very political. It was almost like that group of people were very interested in moving chess pieces around.
Huh.
Very, very, very professional, very, very businesslike, wearing suits. And that group of people had a secondary group of people around them, but they were off to one side, and I felt that was a security detail that was watching them. So I instantly knew that this was an important set of people. Now, during the remote viewing, I picked up that they had a meeting with another group of people that were from out of town that traveled to see these guys. Now, the second group of people, they were a bit more, I don't want to call them downcast, but they weren't as professional, but they were trying to appear as professional. So they were wearing suits, but it felt like the suits weren't quite
they
right.
They were wannabes.
Yeah. Almost. It was very strange. I couldn't get the right words for it. They were wearing suits, but they didn't feel like suits were what they should be wearing. And they were very cool. These were a bit more street level people, you know. It was nowhere near as political for these guys. It was all about a cold hearted job for them. They again had the same kind of security detail, but again nowhere near as professional as the other ones. As I said, very street level, very harsh people, and I feel that these were aggressors. So the first group were the planners, the chess people, the people making the moves. It feels like this was a first meeting. Both sides were very apprehensive, distrustful of each other. They were shaking hands. They were meeting for the first time to plan this whole event.
How long before the shooting did this meeting occur? Did you get a sense of that?
I'm not sure I did. Bearing in mind, I'm having to think back here to what I did on video many months ago.
Could it have occurred a day or two before at the scene of the crime, or was it longer in planning, do you think?
I think it was longer in planning.
Okay.
But right. You know, that's just a feeling from it. It felt like this was planned well in advance.
Got it.
Probably went back months.
Mm-hmm.
It did have that feeling about it, yes. Yes. And it felt like it was a meeting in a public, not a public place, but you know, almost like a hotel or a conference room or something like that. And it was almost, and it was very strange because it was almost like you would expect a business meeting to go on between two parties that had never met before. It had that kind of feel about it. Very male. There, I couldn't find any women anywhere in the vicinity of this whole thing, which instantly made me think, well, this has got to be, you know, something slightly in the past, because women weren't involved to those levels in the past as they are nowadays. It was a very forced situation, very intense, very kind of official and apprehensive. I can't describe how distrustful each group was of each other. And there was a real sense of dread there, and it felt really dark. You know, I was very uneasy doing this target. It felt really, really kind of dark. I could feel like they had a nefarious goal in mind.
That would probably be the feeling when you have feds meeting with gangsters.
Gangsters would be a perfect explanation for this aggressive group, the secondary group that kind of met, that didn't feel right in suits. You know, they were wearing suits, but they didn't feel right in them.
Well, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, in fact, the head of it, even wrote a book and said that organized crime killed Kennedy. So there's really no question that organized crime was involved. And then we know through the church committee and other government investigations that there were actual meetings between government officials and mafia chieftains. I remember one meeting was in a hotel in Florida. And so this to me sounds like exactly what one of those meetings would be like, where you have federal officials and mobsters meeting together. They don't trust each other. They're very apprehensive of each other. The government people are feel like they're really demeaning themselves by lowering themselves to deal with these gangsters, and the gangsters are feeling uneasy because, you know, usually they're on opposite sides of the law. And yet, in this case, they had a common interest, which was to get rid of Kennedy.
Yep, that totally makes sense.
I have a question, and this is a little bit out of context. And, Jim, you'd probably know this, but all that talk about Greer and silly talk, but why did Greer stop the car where he did in the kill zone? Has anyone ever addressed that? What was the reason given for that stop?
No, in fact, well, you got to understand that the whole crime was covered up at the level of the federal government. And so that's why when the Warren Commission, there were witnesses, plenty of witnesses, who said the car stopped, okay, between the shots. And yet the government, they simply said that, well, the car was going an average of 11 miles an hour down Elm Street. Well, the trick there was average, okay? When they turned the corner, they almost bumped up on a curb, that 120-degree turn, and then they probably started picking up a little bit of speed, and then the brakes came on, slowed to almost a complete stop, and then the gas and the brake lights come off, and the car speeds off. And so, you know, at one point it stopped, at one point it's going 20 miles an hour, so
there's your
that
11.
Allows them to say,
yeah.
Well, this is an average of 11 miles an hour,
thank
making
you.
It sound like the mm-hmm. car never slowed or stopped.
Yeah, thanks for that. I still ingrained in my mind is that Secret Service agent getting off the passenger side, looking back toward the camera, whoever's videotaping it, holding his hands, palm up. What the hell are you doing?
Yeah, that was at Love Field. That's when the Secret Service agents who were normally stationed on the
back
side of the
yeah.
rear of the car, there was a foot rest there along with the handhold, and they usually rode on the rear of the car. And as they were leaving Love Field, the head of the Secret Service detail waved them off. And so one of the agents, you know, throws his hands up like, "What? You know, what's happening here?"
Yep.
It was very much against protocol.
Yep. Yep. Okay.
But this is the type of thing. This and the cover up is what elevates this from a Texas homicide, which at that time, legally, that's all it was, to a national coup d'etat.
You know, there's other data that we're not talking about, but it's that are relevant, that are reported in the DVD, and that is that the, I have to sort of condition how I talk about this, because I want to say that remote viewing data cannot prove anything. It's just like any data that you get. You have to accumulate a lot of information and you build a case for it. In a court of law, you build a case and then a judge or a jury decides based on whatever is presented to them who, you know, whether somebody's likely guilty or innocent. But there are data that we do present, that are sketches of the very top people in the meetings, the very top people who organize this thing. And one of the people that is sketched by Dick Allgaier, the sketch is almost a tracing of a picture of J. Edgar Hoover. Meaning it looks, and on the DVD, we actually put the picture of J. Edgar Hoover and the sketch side by side just so you can see. It's almost as if Dick had tracing paper on top of the picture and was tracing it out. He described it as the jowly guy, but everything was amazing. So we can't not say that this proves it was J. Edgar Hoover. It just says that it remarkable resemblance. The other thing is that Dick said that he followed the guy to his car, and he described the car that the guy drives, or the guy rode around in, and he describes it as a black Cadillac. And then we show a picture of J. Edgar Hoover's car, and indeed it's a black Cadillac that looks exactly like that picture. Mm-hmm. That does not prove it was J. Edgar Hoover, mm-hmm. but it is concerning. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. Dick said that whoever this jowly guy is, he's afraid of the Attorney General. And now that would have been Robert Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's just think about this. And I'm not saying that this proves anything. I'm just speculating at this point. But if this was an inside job, a coup d'etat, as Jim Morris just said, and for some, you know, and some people in the government said, we've got to get rid of this guy. Well, if they did not include the FBI in the actual job, then the FBI would have been surprised by it, caught off guard, and they would have launched an immediate investigation, and they would have traced it and found out who did it. So
right.
If you're going to have an inside job, it seems logical to think or posit the possibility that, or even the probability that they would have included J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI in the actual planning of the operation. Otherwise, they would have been caught. The FBI would have, you know, aimed all barrels at them and got them and handed them over to the
Justice
Department.
Oh, there would have at least been a number of statements made by the FBI and the media.
So if you,
well,
if
Courtney,
you
put, let me ask you this: I know you've done enough study of the subject. Who was one of the most powerful people in Washington who happened to be very close friends and, in fact, neighbors to J. Edgar Hoover?
Are you talking about his principal assistant?
No, I'm talking about someone who had power over him.
Oh, that what you're, I bet you're talking about the head of the CIA. What's the guy's name again?
No, I'm talking about Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Oh, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Who then took the mantle of presidency from Kennedy. And it's now just widely documented and widely known that both Johnson and his buddy J. Edgar Hoover detested the Kennedys, and Hoover indeed was fearful of Robert Kennedy, who as Attorney General was literally his boss.
Yeah, but they're also by them a tremendous amount of animosity towards the Kennedys from within the CIA also.
Right.
So the problem was it started with the Bay of Pigs, because as soon as Kennedy got in power, he was handed the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was cooked up during the late Eisenhower administration. And
Richard Nixon.
The vice president cooked that up.
Yeah. But exactly. But the point is that the CIA was the one who was organizing it. And they, when the Cuban expatriates landed, of course, Kennedy had by that time said, this is not going to work. This is stupid. There's not going to be an uprising. And so he pulled the military, the CIA, all the support personnel back. And the Cuban expatriates were all shot or arrested when they got there. That was a huge embarrassment and, a huge failing of the CIA. And they were really badly affected. Also, I understand that Kennedy was thinking at the time of a complete reorganization of the CIA. He was
Worse than that, Courtney, he was quoted in the New York Times as saying after the failure of the Bay of Pigs and his belief that he had been double-crossed by the CIA and lied to, he said he was going to splinter them into 1,000 pieces and cast them to the winds. He was going to do away with it.
So you see, there was a lot of potential for people above J. Edgar Hoover to sort of coordinate their own mutual interests and say, this has got to go. It's either he's going to go or we're going to go. And so if somebody in those higher levels decided this has to happen, it makes sense. I'm not saying this proves it, but it makes sense that they would have contacted J. Edgar Hoover and said, make this happen. And if you look at all of the data that are in the remote viewing project, it looks like J. Edgar Hoover had a very high principal assistant do it. Meaning J. Edgar Hoover said, do this. That guy went out and did it. And that guy was the one who organized the meetings. And the meetings is what Daz actually witnessed. So what Dick Allgaier's real addition is the sort of the cast of characters at the very top, and the second in charge of the cast of characters, the guy below the jowly guy, who looked like J. Edgar Hoover, he was the one who organized the business type guys to meet with the gangster type guys Des Smith described. The street guys. And it's very likely from these data that the street guys had ex-military or paramilitary people in their operation. So if they were organized crime, some of those people look like they had, governmental training. They were not just thugs.
Was it
from
Clyde
the
Tolson, Jim?
Yeah, that's who you're talking about.
His assistant, yeah.
He would have been the one.
Daz, let me ask you this. In your sitting in on these meetings between these two groups, was there any... did they give any thought to maybe we shouldn't be doing this? Did they have any idea that what they were doing is wrong, or were they convincing themselves that this was a necessary evil, a necessary deed?
They knew what they were doing, and it was You know, it was very dark.
There wasn't any altruistic thought to them, huh?
Okay. No, nothing at all. And so another part that I haven't discussed yet is there was another person involved, not as part of the meetings, but I describe in detail as well, another person who was very manipulated by all these people. And it was almost like a form of mind control on this person. And he was recruited, and it was very covert. And over a period of time, he was kind of told lies and brought into the process of all this. He was very confused, very messed up. And this person was very integrated in and around the arts of spycraft. And I feel that this...
Can you
this
describe that person? Was he young, old, you know?
I say he's a male. He's a thin, he's educated, he's scared, fearful, he's been used and abused and manipulated, and I wrote down that he was a soldier. Clearly this man was hiding things, he was insecure, very scared, very complex, and he internally he had lots of mixed thoughts and emotions. And I wrote down that this young soldier was key to the entire planning, but he was intentionally manipulated differently than everyone else.
It sounds like Lee Harvey Oswald, after all,
was a Marine.
That exactly sounds like Lee Harvey Oswald. You see, if this was an inside job, part of the planning would definitely have been to get a patsy, meaning they knew that they couldn't kill the president and not have the guilt and not have somebody found guilty. So they knew that they had to have somebody as part of the overall plan that they were going to lay this on.
Think
so
about poor Oswald waiting to be rescued by his superiors and then realizing too late he had been hung out to swing in the wind.
Right. And keep in mind that Oswald, as Lyndon Johnson said, is a very unusual fellow. And he had ties and connections not only through the military and through the CIA and through the Office of Naval Intelligence and through the government, but also through the organized crime.
His question, Jim.
In New Orleans was tied in with the Carlos Marcello gang.
Right, question on that. The Bay of Pigs cancellation, JFK canceled it, withdrew. The mob had to have been very unhappy with that because they lost their big cash cow in Havana.
Right. Exactly. Well, every powerful and vicious group in America hated Kennedy by the fall of 1963. And that includes organized crime, the Chicago mob, the Hollywood mob, the Florida mob, the New Orleans mob, and also the CIA, who's now fearful that he might disband them.
Destroy them,
And then, of course, the military, who was angered because he refused to go along with the Joint Chiefs plan to nuke Southeast Asia. In fact, he was talking about maybe not prosecuting that war. And the corporate America was down on him because the Kennedy Tax Act of 1962 started closing their tax loopholes, because he thought they should be paying their fair share of taxes, and they didn't go for that. He was even talking about doing away with the bedrock of oil money, which is the oil depletion allowance, which is provides all the immense oil.
And then his war on the Fed, gold-backed currency.
Right.
So that's another one.
Curtail the power of the Fed. He also had let it be known that he was not going to gladly hand over nuclear secrets and nuclear technology
to the Israelis.
Yeah, and
he told Ben Gurion, we are going to inspect
the Dimona plant, make sure they weren't making any nuclear weapons. So they all had a reason.
Ben Gurion said, "No, you're not." You know, Fletcher Prouty, Jim. I asked him this question. He said he didn't list it like we just did, but he said, Jeff, he said, there were a lot of people with reasons at that time.
That's right.
Around the one in Kennedy gone.
And David Rockefeller, by the way, was paying out of his own pocket for page ads in the New York Times blasting Kennedy's economic policies. So at the very, very top,
wow.
You know, and once the Rockefellers and their banking families, once they decide that this guy's a problem, then we're not going to do anything if something happened to him, then that freed up all the lower echelon guys to put the plan into motion.
Well, okay. We have about 15 minutes left, and I want to make sure we remind you, you can get the DVD of this extraordinary remote viewing exercise with Dick and Daz. Just go to the Far Site. Give the address, Courtney.
Yeah, it's www.farsight, like seeing far,
yeah.
FARSIGHT.org, ORG, because we're a nonprofit. And the video is available in two forms. One is as a DVD through Amazon, and the other is instantly as a video on demand through Vimeo. Now, there's two parts. The first part is called the JFK Assassination, Part 1, The Shooters. Those are the people who actually shot him in Dealey Plaza. And then the second part is JFK Assassination, Part 2, The Organizers. And those are the people who did the organizing of the event. Both DVDs paint the entire picture of what happened. They're both actually spine-tingling in the sense of we have not heard of a single person who was bored even a second watching this, because this is live remote viewing done in an engaging manner right in front of you, captured on video. It's spellbinding.
Yeah. All right, Daz, back to you. What do you want to put on the table next?
I don't think I have an awful lot to say on the shooters, I thought, really. I had a real sense of this person being manipulated, this young soldier. I did get at the end that this person did realize very late in the game that he was being manipulated. Mm-hmm. But he knew at that point it was just too late to help himself. And then my session just goes into a death event. So he died not long after that realization.
So you went through the, we'll assume it's Lee Harvey Oswald, his death too.
I kind of touched on that a little bit, but I went nowhere into it as much as I did on the death of the passenger in the car, JFK himself. No, I just knew that, you know, his final outcome of this entire event was a death very closely associated after he realized that he'd been duped.
Sure had.
Do you have anything else you can add to his death? Can you tell us, you know, was it, when you say shortly after, are we talking about days or hours or months? What?
Yeah, I don't know, I'm afraid. That would have been a case for Courtney giving us another target and then, you know, going back into it and re-looking at it. Yeah, I didn't get that. All I have on my notes and in the sense of what I wrote on the board was that he died not long after the realization of being manipulated. But the manipulation, was really, really long-term and really horrible.
Pretty ugly stuff,
Yeah, it was not nice at all. You know, it was a lot of social kind of and psychological engineering done on this guy.
You know, I might add that this publication of these two videos, remote viewing documentaries on the JFK, really put nice closure on this entire thing that's very topical now. It took us a long time, and I don't mean just the remote viewing side, but those investigators, to figure out what actually happened. And this really does paint the really clear picture. So if people wanted to really understand it from a forensic point of view and from an eyewitness point of view, using the best remote viewers on the planet, the combination of Jim Mars' book, Crossfire, which has a brand new updated version, 2013, so it's very recent, and these two videos combined.
So that's
if
it.
Someone really wanted to study what really happened and get a full picture of all the forensics, all the the detailed work, it's to read the book, The Crossfire, the updated version by Jim Mars, and watch both of these videos. You really get the entire picture, and it took a... I mean, this thing happened a long time ago. It took us till now to finally put it all together. The best type of detective work from a remote viewing point of view, from a forensic point of view, coming together. Now the package is complete.
I agree. Jim's book is magnificent. This is information from the other side, so to speak, which is the ultimate validation of what we can do on this side. I mean, Daz's description of the death experience was unforgettable. Were you emotionally overcome by this, Daz? I think you mentioned something about that, that it was kind of difficult.
Yeah, I was at one point. And for me, it's one of the first times I've encountered that. And bearing in mind, I've done over 280 missing person cases for police forces in the United States. So I'm not a person that hasn't been involved in death in some quite horrendous, you know, sexual kind of things with people before.
Yeah.
But to feel what this person went through, and then the calmness and the nice feelings they felt on the other side in this totally new
release.
State of spiritual awakening. It's almost like a spiritual awakening that usually takes a person a lifetime, but in a matter of minutes. That was awesome to see. Yeah, very, very, very interesting that was. And I do, I being a man, you try to hide these things, but I do feel I did choke up a couple of times during the rune session of that one.
Jim, looking back at Jack Kennedy, and I'm not sure if Daz has any read on this or not, was he a man who felt and he was aware of his enemies to obviously a substantial degree? Obviously. Had to be. He's a smart
Absolutely.
Man.
He even at one point said, if somebody was saying, aren't you worried, you know, are you fearful? He said, if they want to get me, you know, they can get me. He said, all they got to do is put somebody in a high building with a rifle. You know, I mean, he knew exactly what could have happened.
Yeah. Now, did he have in his political conscience, his moral conscience, the idea that he was going to make big changes in this country, where it was going? Was he a visionary in the best sense of that term, a political visionary?
I think so, and let me put this caveat there that I was brought up in the Baptist Church, and we were told that if he was elected that the Pope would run the country, you know, and so it was anti-Catholicism against him. We all thought of him as some kind of East Coast liberal, you know, because his family was wealthy. And then as we go along, we find out that his dad, Joe Kennedy, made his first money during Prohibition running alcohol. Mm. And so, you know, he was not that popular in Texas, at least among the intelligentsia and the educated people. But I have come around over the years to realize that there was more to the guy than I think most people even realize. First off, he was the first American president who was actually born in the 20th century. He was only about 45. He was one of the youngest presidents we've had. And he was highly educated. And he was educated with a worldview. One of the first things he did to gain public attention was, and he might have had a ghostwriter, but nevertheless it carried his name, and that was he wrote a book called Why We Slept, and it was all about how that Britain had slept and had not paid attention to the rise of the Nazis and Hitler, and had kind of brought World War II on themselves. So he obviously had a worldview, a historical view. And then as he got in office, there's so many things he did that showed he was trying to, and we've already run through some of that. He was trying to curtail the power of the Federal Reserve System, that private banking system that has us, you know, in a chokehold with, you know, $20 trillion in debt. He's also trying to curtail the power of the military, curtail the power of the CIA. He was seriously working to try to end the Cold War, and he and Khrushchev had reached some pretty good accommodations with each other. And in fact, most people don't realize this, but just a few months after Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Khrushchev was more or less pushed out and sent away. They didn't kill him, but he was edged out too.
He was unplugged.
Both sides took over.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this has been amazing.
And of course, we all know that he was he did not do a lot towards civil rights, but he was not opposed to them, and he was allowing that movement to progress along. So he was doing all kinds of things. This was at an early time. Things had not come to fruition, but he was beginning to take the steps towards peace and prosperity and equality, not only in this country, but around the world, and that's why there's a majority of people in the world today who still hold him in very high regard.
Well, he was coalescing, I think, en route to becoming a potential giant.
If he had served out the rest of his term, he would have. There was no question he was going to get reelected. His approval ratings in the fall of '63 were something like 65, close to 70%.
Mm.
So he would get a reelected, and he had already let it be known that when he got reelected, everybody around him knew that when he got reelected in '64. Johnson was not going to be on the ticket. Hoover was going to be forced to retire. The military was going to get curtailed. There would be no Vietnam War, and organized crime would begin, and that would continue to be prosecuted. And maybe, as one Kennedy family member told me years ago, they might have broken the back of organized crime in this country.
That all? Jeez. Well, there you go. Let me ask one quick question here. We've got 4 minutes left. Daz and Courtney, where is remote viewing going next? What are you going to do with this? This tool, which really is a dangerous tool to the powers that be, because I don't mind saying, and I hope it doesn't put you off, but there really are no more secrets. They are wide open. They have nowhere to hide with remote viewing.
Yeah, you know, that's true. You know, I know where we're going now into 2016. We're going to continue some new mysteries, like we've been doing. These mystery projects were to show people what can be done, why it's important. But we're going to also go into a very important project that returns us back to the science stuff. We're going to revisit an old experiment that we did, which was a multiple universes project, which was published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And that is to use remote viewing to see the future, to predict the future. We have one experimental design that we know works, and we're going to do it. The difference between the way we're going to do it this time and the way we did it in the past is we're going to have the video, we're going to have the remote viewing done on video and upload it to the YouTube, which has a timestamp on it. And then we're going to be looking at remote viewing things that happen a month later. And the real interesting wrinkle is we're going to have the person, which hopefully will be Jim Mars. We've been talking about that. The person that picks the target will be picking it a month after that. So if we have something like the reviewing done in January, they'll be remote viewing something that happens in February.
Uh-huh.
But Jim Mars won't pick that thing until March.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And we'll go through that, and we'll keep on going through that for a year. Now, if you think about this for the last year, there were a lot of interesting stories. I mean, there was the Paris terrorist bombing. There was the Malaysian airliner. All types of stuff happen. Now, imagine someone like Jim Mars being able to pick the mystery that happened the previous month, the one that gripped the whole planet, and then to know that the remote viewing for that was done the month before that. So that's what we're going to be trying. We're going to be trying something like that. We know that experimental design works as long as the tasker, the person who picks the target, has the event in his or her past. It's okay if the viewers do the work before that. So the viewers can do their work first. The event can happen after that. So they're remote viewing something in the future. As long as the tasker, the one who picks it, has it, you know, that the event itself is in their past. So the event goes in between when the viewing happens and when the target is actually picked.
Yeah.
That experimental design works. And the game plan for that is to tip the scales of mainstream science so that it's finally accepted as a real phenomenon. So we're continuing with the mysteries, but we're also going into the science realm in sort of a very entertaining and energetic way. So we're trying to flip the planet, to be quite honest. We're trying to take down a planet and turn a species in a different direction for the betterment of everybody. And that's the goal. Dez, you want to say anything about that?
Not I don't really know much about that project yet because you're trying to keep everything as secret from me as possible. But on where remote viewing's going, I mean, you know, the JFK project for me is a perfect example because we're taking an art form of remote viewing, which is esoteric in nature, you know, using intuition, and then we're combining it with the amazing amount of research that people like Jim Mars has done over decades that have given us such a mass of supporting evidence to be able to then verify the intuitive data. That to me, this kind of thing is almost my perfect project, really, because there is so much there to balance it out and to check, you know, the accuracy.
Having two brilliant, talented men like this to work with must just give you a feeling of awe at times.
Well, say, Jeff, just think what kind of project that would be where you can show that they remote viewed something and then prove that it was accurate, but they did it before the event.
I know.
I mean, how phenomenal is that?
Yeah. My point in asking Courtney that question was I don't want the powers that be thinking that anything is going to be directed to upset their game. They're doing their thing. He's going in far more interesting and eclectic areas. This is going to be a fascinating year for remote viewing.
You know, the only thing you can say, Jeff, is that we wouldn't have gotten this far if there wasn't somebody out there,
indeed,
you know, running interference for us.
Indeed.
So we're not doing this without help. Otherwise, we never would have gotten this far. So you can assume that we're going to be able to keep on going.
Very good. Well, I'm here to help in any way I can. And Daz, it's great to have you on again. Thank you. You be well. Take good care. And congratulations.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. Courtney, thanks for being here. You're so erudite and articulate. It's always great to hear you.
Jeff, I really enjoy coming here. And this is and not only am I really love coming to be on your show especially, but it's a real treat to be here with Daz because I don't get many chances to be interviewed with Daz. And so that's a real treat. And Jim Mars. This is my first time to be on the radio with Jim. And there's no bigger fan for Jim than myself and Daz. So it's a great show for us. So I want to thank you, Jeff, for organizing
this. Of course.
This.
Oh, of course. And Dick, who's listening in right now, you're included in all this. And we've got three programs here done on this extraordinary target, the John Kennedy assassination. And they are in the books. They are history now. And they go perfectly hand in glove with Jim's work of 52 years. So, James, thank you, sir, for being here. Always an honor and a pleasure, and we always learn.
I will talk with you next year.
Indeed you will. All righty. Good night. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
All right. And thanks for all of your time tonight. That was, again, just a knockout program, and it's all there. And I think Courtney's use of the word closure is what I feel. With Jim's work and now this validation on top of it, we know what happened. And we will be back tomorrow night.